The last few weeks we've been looking at the history of the nation, the kingdom of Israel, and kingdom of Judah. We started a number of weeks ago when we talked about the United Kingdom and saw that during three kings, all of Israel was united together as one nation. We then, the last few weeks, we've been looking at what happened after that nation split. That nation had a civil war and split between the north and the south. You had the northern nation of Israel and the southern nation of Judah, and we've looked to see what happened in each of those nations. And we saw that as the faith of the king went, so often went the faith and the well-being of the nation. And we saw that the northern nation was totally annihilated and destroyed by the Assyrians because of their continued rejection of God as God, because of their continued faithlessness and worship of other gods. And then last week and the week before, we took a look at the southern nation of Judah, and we saw kind of back and forth. We saw some kings that were faithful, some kings that were not, and we saw that the faithlessness somewhat prevailed for most of the time, and so then God allowed the Babylonians to come in and conquer Judah. And that's kind of where we left it off. Now, we've seen throughout these studies that God has been extremely patient with these people. He's made it clear to them what he wants. He's made it clear to us what he wants. And yet these people continue to reject him and follow other gods. And rather than immediately destroying them as they deserved, God in his great grace and mercy and love continued to reach out to these people, continued to have extreme patience, patience beyond what we can imagine, to try to get these people to come back to him. He sent prophets. We talked about this a few weeks ago, about the role of the prophet in going to Israel, going to God's people, and calling them back to him, reminding them of their special calling, reminding them of the destiny that God had called them to, and that is to be blessed, to be a blessing. Well, today we're going to talk about another role of the prophet, and probably more so a role that we think of when we think of prophets today, because we look back at the prophets and what we remember is what they talked about God was going to do. And so we're going to be looking at that in our lesson of pointing ahead. Now, since this is our first lesson, since we finished the story and the study number 16 on Judah, the southern nation of Judah, let's first do a recap of what we learned during that study. So you might turn to your picture on Old Testament 16, the crumbling south, and remember some of the stuff that we talked about. For one thing, we talked a little bit about some of the differences between the northern nation of Israel and the southern nation of Judah, and we saw there were a lot of differences. Differences ranging from geographic differences, that the land was lush and fertile and a land flowing with milk and honey in the north, but in the south it was a little more desertish and not really attractive to others. The north, northern nation was in regular contact with lots of people because of trade routes that went through there, where the south was a little bit more isolated. So geographically there were a lot of differences there. We especially saw we also saw that the number of dynasties, as we looked at the whole, all the kings of the northern nation of Israel, we saw there were nine different dynasties, nine different ruling families. And yet, out of all those nine, only two of them lasted more than two generations. And there was a lot of turnover and a lot of turmoil in the kingships in the north. However, on the southern side, there was one dynasty. There was one dynasty. Whose dynasty? David's dynasty. David, Solomon, Rehoboam, etc. And so that continued on. How did the nations contrast in their faithlessness? Well, it was very clear. Israel, the northern nation, was faithless from the very beginning and remained so. They continued to walk in the ways of Jeroboam, in the religion that Jeroboam had created, and that kept them away from God. And things got even worse during Baalism times and things like that. In the southern nation of Judah, well, we had a lot of bad times there too. In fact, some of the bad times in Judah were even worse, even more faithless than what we saw in Israel. But there were good times. There were times when the king was faithful. There were times when the people were faithful. And so we had a lot of good kings too. So you had a little bit of both in the southern kingdom. Now, as we look at the kings in our picture, the first four kings, now, you know, we don't quite have the colors in the crumbling south picture that we had in the crumbling north picture that set apart the different eras. But the first four, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, and Jehoshaphat, made up the kings during the period of civil strife. This coincided with the period of civil strife in the north because that's what civil strife is. It was the strife between the north and the south. And out of those, which of them were faithful? Well, if you remember, Rehoboam was not. He turned to other gods. He was not, he kind of walked in his dad's footsteps. Solomon had turned to other gods at the end of his life or towards the end of his life. Abijah followed in the ways of his father Rehoboam, but Asa brought great reforms, and so did Jehoshaphat. So two of them, Asa and Jehoshaphat, were both considered to be faithful kings. We see in our picture a volcano on Rehoboam, and that reminds us that Egypt threatened Judah at that time. Shishak came in and raided Jerusalem and took the valuables, plundered the temple, plundered the palace, plundered Jerusalem. And so we had the threat from Egypt there during Rehoboam. Looking at Asa, you know, Asa was a great faithful king, but then later on, after his 35th year, war returned. He had peace for many, many years. But then what happened in his 36th year is he looked to Syria for help rather than looking to God. And he forgot where his help came from. He had so much experience with God reaching out and helping him, and he forgot it later on in his life. And we see a theme like that often. And we see that kind of in our own lives. We've been called to persevere in our faith. And Asa did not entirely persevere in his faith. So because he looked to Syria for help and rather than turning to God, God said, okay, you're going to continue to see warfare for the rest of your reign. And he did. Now then Jehoshaphat, his son, took over, and there we see a peace flag. And that reminds us that civil strife ended under Jehoshaphat. And the way that he did that, we see with a wedding ring under that peace flag. And that reminds us that he married his son to the daughter of the king of the north. Now that wedding ring has a smudge on it, and that's because this was not a good thing to do, because the king of the north at the time was the worst king that the north ever had, Ahab. And his son, Jehoshaphat's son, married Ahab's daughter, married Jezebel's daughter, and as a result, brought in a time of Baalism in the south to correspond with the Baalism in the north, because that Baalism family was now involved in the south. And that's what we see with the snake on Jehoram, Ahaziah, and Athaliah. Now, which of the three Baalism rulers were faithful? Not a one. At least not faithful to Yahweh, not faithful to God, maybe faithful to Baal. Okay? Jehoram, we see signs of what these people are all about from the very beginning. When Jehoram takes over, his first act is to go kill his brothers so that he can protect his throne, so his brothers won't be a threat to him. He was faithless. Well, he was married to Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. So he brought Baalism in, and God punished him by allowing him to lose a number of battles, by having his family taken captive, and by having him die from a very painful bowel disease. His son Ahaziah was killed not very long after he took over, and he was killed by Jehu, who was the commander in the northern nation of Israel that God had called upon to become the next king and had chartered him with purging Omri's household, that is Ahab's household, of whom Ahaziah was Ahab's grandson, right? His mother was Athaliah, whose father was Ahab. So he was killed in that purge by Jehu. Athaliah then took over, that is Ahaziah's mom, Jehoram's wife, and Ahab's daughter. She took over, and you saw more along the lines of what she had had Jehoram do earlier. She goes and kills off her grandson. She goes and kills off whoever she can to get rid of David's line. But God had promised to David that he would always have a descendant on the throne. So what happened? Well, there was a baby. Ahaziah had a baby, and that baby was Joash, was hidden by his aunt, that is Ahaziah's sister Jehoiada, or Jehosheba, who was married to Jehoiada. This is where we get all sorts of names confused. But Jehoiada was the high priest, and so they hid the baby in the temple so that Athaliah couldn't get to him. Okay? And then that baby grew up, and when that baby was a ripe age of 7, Jehoiada the high priest showed his strength and staged a coup and pronounced Joash to be the king. The people supported that. Athaliah was killed, and Joash was the next king. And we see that he was faithful all the years of Jehoiada, because Jehoiada ruled kind of in his stead until he grew up. And he followed that. But then once Jehoiada died, we saw that Joash rejected God. So much so that even had Jehoiada's son killed for saying that God didn't like what Joash was doing. So Joash started great, but when it was really up to him, he was not a good king. Okay. Now this is during the period of the Golden Age. Okay. If you remember the Northern Nation, we had this period of wealth and prosperity, and we had a similar period of wealth and prosperity here. Now we see that Uzziah was the peak of that wealth and prosperity age, and that's why his segment is colored gold. There were 4 Golden Age kings. Okay, Joash, Amaziah, Uzziah, and Jotham. Of those, which of them were faithful? Remember? All 4. Now, Joash started faithful, and then he changed. And so you've got some counters there. But this was, during this period of wealth and prosperity, was also a time of faithfulness. Why were the kings of this era given wealth, power, and success? As a result of their faithfulness to God. Now we see a couple of banners at this time. Isaiah and Micah popped up here, and they prophesied to Judah from the reigns of Uzziah to the reign of Hezekiah. Okay, so that those flags remind us of that. We know that Isaiah and Hezekiah spent a lot of time together, so that can help us remember that Isaiah and Micah came from Uzziah to Hezekiah. Amaziah, why did he lose favor with God? Well, he was faithful to God, and then later on, when he went and fought a battle in Edom, he kept some of the gods, some of the idols that from that battle after the victory, and that lost favor with God. How did Uzziah lose favor with God? Well, he got a big head and decided that, hey, the priest can burn incense. I want to burn incense to God also. But that was a privilege. That was a duty that God had given to the priests, not to other people, not even to the king. And so when he entered the temple to burn incense, that was against God's will, and then God brought leprosy on him, and he was unable to continue being the king because he had to go into quarantine. And that's how Jotham then was prepared for kingship, because he ruled in his father's absence while his father was still alive, because his father was quarantined for the leprosy. Following these 4 Golden Age kings, we then have the period of rapid decline, a period of decline very similar to the period of decline that we had in the Northern Kingdom of Israel. So which of these 4 were faithful? Okay. You've got Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, and Ammon. Which of those 4? Only 1. Hezekiah. Okay, Hezekiah was the only one. How evil was Ahaz? Well, Ahaz was the worst. Ahaz kind of You know, his name sounds a little bit like Ahab, the bad guy of the north. Well, he was kind of a bad guy of the south. He worshiped pretty much any kind of other god that he could come across. He even sacrificed his sons to these gods. He closed the temple. He put Baal altars on every corner. Okay. We see a manuscript peg on the Ahaz segment, and that reminds us that he made an alliance with Assyria against Syria and Israel. He was having trouble with Israel and with Syria, and so he made an alliance with Assyria, but that didn't turn out to be a good thing to do, and he ended up, and Judah ended up becoming a vassal, becoming subject to Assyria, and that's what we see with those coins there on Ahaz. Under Hezekiah, we've got three volcanoes there, and Assyria is the one by itself there that reminds us that things were tough with Assyria during Hezekiah, and he struggled with Assyria, and he made alliances with Egypt and then with Babylon. Those are the other two volcanoes on Hezekiah to help fight those, but he did so always seeking the guidance of God. Okay, he was, unlike any kings before or after him, he trusted the Lord and sought the Lord's favor in whatever he did. What reforms did he do? Well, he reversed all the negatives of his father Ahaz. He purified the temple, purified the priests, dedicated the people, started celebrating the Passover, okay, returned Judah to faithfulness, especially after his father's faithlessness that he had led Judah astray. We had a time when Hezekiah was sick and on his deathbed, and because of his turning to God, God said that he would live longer, and as a sign, he gave him the sign of the sun's shadow going backwards 10 steps on a stairway, and so you've got this miraculous sign there. How did Hezekiah's reform stand up under his son Manasseh? Well, Manasseh reversed them all. And Manasseh turned things back kind of towards the way it was under Ahaz, under his grandfather. Manasseh was one of the worst. So what did God plan as a result of Manasseh's evil? Decided, okay, Judah just continues to reject me, and the detestable practices that Judah is undergoing now are worse than the detestable practices that of the people that were in this land that I had told Israel to get rid of. And so as a result, I'm going to treat them the same, and I'm going to turn them over to their enemies, and I'm going to get rid of this nation. Now, what happened then is the Babylonians came in. They took Manasseh captive, took him back to Babylon. In prison, he repented. He turned back to God. He turned to faith in God. And God forgave him. That's a great story. I mean, as horribly sinful, as horribly wicked as Manasseh was in leading people away from God, God still forgave him. And as a result, God had him return to Jerusalem and put him back in power as king. So a great story of forgiveness, showing God's great patience and God's great forgiveness to people even who reject him greatly. All right, next we have Josiah, who was one of the better ones. Okay, he made a lot of reforms. He purged all the idols and repaired the temple. He found the Bible and so read the Bible and taught people the Bible, taught the law, celebrated the Passover as it had never been celebrated before. He went throughout all the countryside, destroying all the Baal altars, the altars to other gods, including the altar that Jeroboam had set up in Bethel, and in doing so fulfilled the prophecy that the man of God had made when Jeroboam had first set up that altar, way back in 1 Kings. Did Jeroboam's reforms change God's plan to wipe out Judah as God had decided under Manasseh? No, God had made the decision, but he wasn't going to do it during the reign of Josiah. He was going to wait, so it postponed it. Now we see a volcano there on Josiah, and that reminds us that during Josiah's reign, Babylon replaced Assyria as the world power and the threat. We also see the Jeremiah banner pop up under Josiah. That reminds us that Jeremiah started his ministry as prophet at that time. And he was there for all the rest of the kings and on into the exile, which we'll talk about as we keep going in future weeks. Jehoahaz. What happened to Jehoahaz? If you remember, he was deported to Egypt by Pharaoh Necho. Okay, the Pharaoh of Egypt came and took him, and he set up Jehoiakim as king. And that's what we see with the E coin on there, that Judah was a vassal or was subject to Egypt during Jehoiakim's reign. And then when Egypt fell to Babylon, then Judah became vassal to Babylon. And so there's the B coin there. The problem then is that Jehoiakim decided he didn't want to continue to pay the tribute to Babylon, and that brought the Babylonians in, and he was deported by Nebuchadnezzar. Then his son Jehoiachin, within a few months, he and his family surrendered to Nebuchadnezzar, and he, his family, all the important people, all the intelligent people, the wealthy people, the nobles, the military, anybody of any kind of importance, all but the poorest of the land, were then gathered up and taken in exile, to exile in Babylon. This is called the first exile, okay, because there's still some people left. And those people left were then put under the reign of Zedekiah. And Zedekiah started out as a subject to Babylon, but then he revolted. He rebelled, and that brought the wrath of Nebuchadnezzar. He had also made an oath in God's name that he would be faithful to Nebuchadnezzar, that he would follow. And so when he broke that oath, he also broke an oath then to God. The deep red color on Zedekiah reminds us that the final exile came then in 586 BC when Zedekiah revolted against Babylon. And then we see the great hands crushing the kingdom. And that reminds us that the southern kingdom was destroyed by the Babylonian hordes. Okay? So that's what we've covered the last couple of weeks. We took 2 weeks to cover that lesson. And now I want to go back just a little bit further, because I mentioned to you that today we're going to talk about the role of the prophet. And you might say, well, you know, we already did that. If you turn back to study 14, study 14 was called Recalling a Destiny. And if you look at that picture, we talked about the role of the prophet. Well, we talked about one of the roles of the prophet, a key role, a very important role of the prophet, the main role for the times that the prophet came for. And what was that? Well, as the title says, is to recall the destiny, to point people back to God, to call God's people to come back to the destiny to which he had called them, to be blessed, to be a blessing. The role of the prophet, we see, is reminding Israel of that destiny. And that's what we see with the prophet here, holding up the pieces of the manuscript that had fallen apart. Okay? Now, let's look at a couple of, let's look at some of the prophets. If we looked at the picture for study 15 on the crumbling north, what prophets do we see there? Well, you see a couple major hitters, right? Elijah and Elisha. And what messages did they speak? They spoke against the Baalism that was predominant there in during the time of Ahab and his descendants there. So they spoke against Baalism and called people back to God from Baalism. Even Elijah, his name, was pointing that out, saying, Yahweh is God. That's what Eliyah, Elijah, means. Okay, we also see Hosea and Amos. What was their calling? What kind of message did they bring? Well, they came during the time of wealth and prosperity, and they talked about the dangers of spiritual laxness during a time of wealth and prosperity, which is something that a message that we need to hear today ourselves, because we live in a time of wealth and prosperity and spiritual laxness. You also have Isaiah, and but if you turn to the study 16, you'll also see Isaiah there, and Isaiah really did come, he focused his attention on the southern nation of Judah, more so than the northern nation of Israel. The reason the Isaiah flag is on the northern nation of Israel, if you recall, is because he then foretold the destruction of the northern nation of Israel. So for the southern nation, we've got Isaiah, Micah, and Jeremiah. And what kind of messages did they bring? Well, they brought messages that dealt with the current situation. Okay? They brought God's word, God's direction, God's messages to the situations of those days. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we keep going on. So if we look at these prophets, okay, Elijah, Elisha, Hosea, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Jeremiah, were these prophets focused on the past? Were they focused on the present? Or were they focused on the future? Well, let's turn to one of those. Let's turn to Isaiah. Okay, in fact, we're going to read a lot out of Isaiah, because out of all these prophets, Isaiah really gives us a great picture of the role of the prophet, and especially in light of what we're going to be talking about today. So Isaiah chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. Hear, O heavens, listen, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I reared children, and I brought them up, but they've rebelled against me. The ox knows his master, and the donkey his owner's manger, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on him. Well, if you look at these verses, you see that the prophet focused on the past, right? The prophet had a good understanding of what God had done, of what the situation has been. Okay, so you see the past there. But go on further to the next verses. Why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is injured, your whole heart afflicted. From the sole of your foot to the top of your head, there's no soundness, only wounds and welts and open sores, not cleansed or bandaged or soothed with oil. And then verse 9, unless Yahweh Almighty has left us some survivors, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. Now, this is talking about the way things are. And so the prophets had a good understanding of what God was doing during their present time. So not only did the prophets look at the past, but they also looked at the present and spoke to the present. Well, going a little further, verse 18, come now, let's reason together, says Yahweh. Though your skins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they're red as crimson, they'll be like wool. If you're willing and obedient, you'll eat the best from the land. But if you resist and rebel, you'll be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Well, there we see that the prophet had a good understanding of what God's plan was, what God was going to do. So he also spoke about the future. So the prophets looked to the past, talked to the present, and foretold the future. Okay? So we've got past, present, and future involved with these prophets. Well, in these messages then of looking at the past, present, and future, and through that, recalling the destiny, okay, as we talked about in study 14, of pointing Israel back to the destiny of being blessed to be a blessing. Besides that, what other kind of messages did the prophet bring? Well, I'll go ahead and tell you. The prophet brought messages of blessings for the faithful, judgment for evil, and a promise of hope. So let's look at some of those. Okay, we'll just pick two of the prophets, okay? From the northern nation, we'll pick Amos. Okay, if you remember, we've got the flags there of Hosea and Amos coming during the time of Jeroboam II. And in the southern nation, we'll pick Micah. Okay, we could pick others, but we'll just pick those two quote-unquote minor prophets. They're called minor prophets because their books are not as big and as like Isaiah or Jeremiah, some of the what would be called the major prophets. So let's see how this works out. Okay, what kind of blessings did the prophets offer to the faithful? And again, we could look at any of the prophets, just out of Amos, Amos 5, verses 4 to 6. This is what Yahweh says to the house of Israel. Seek me and live. Don't seek Bethel. Don't go to Gilgal. Don't journey to Beersheba, for Gilgal will certainly go into exile and Bethel will be reduced to nothing. So, seek the Lord. Seek Yahweh and live. Or he'll sweep through the house of Joseph like a fire. It'll devour and Bethel will have no one to quench it. So, what blessing? Seek the Lord and live. Seek Yahweh and live. It's a message he's got for us as well. As we seek him, that's what he wants. He wants us to come into a relationship with him. And as we seek him, we seek that relationship and he'll fulfill that relationship. And as we seek him, we will live. Okay, Jesus said, seek and you will find. So we're called to seek the Lord. All right, what about Micah? Micah chapter 7, verses 14 to 15. Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock of your inheritance in fertile pasture lands. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in days long ago. As in the days when you came out of Egypt, I will show them my wonders. So here we see that his sheep, that is us, his people, will feed in fertile pasture lands and will see his wonders. Okay? So as we are faithful, then he will bless us in fertile pasture lands. He will bless us with showing us his wonders, revealing himself to us. Okay? So prophets talked about blessings for the faithful, but they also then talked about God being a just God and bringing judgment for evil. Amos chapter 2, verses 4 to 5. This is what Yahweh says. For three sins of Judah, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath, because they have rejected the law of Yahweh and have not kept his decrees, because they have been led astray by false gods, the gods their ancestors followed. I will send fire upon Judah that will consume the fortresses of Jerusalem. So because they've rejected God and his law, God would destroy them, would send fire upon Judah, okay, and destroy Judah. This is Amos who spoke to the northern nation, but now bringing condemnation on Judah, the southern nation of Judah, because of their rejection of God. And then if we go on in the next verses, well, he says the same sort of stuff for Israel. All right, Micah 6, verse 16. You have, and this, remember, Micah spoke to the southern nation. And Micah says, you have observed the statutes of Omri and all the practices of Ahab's house. Okay? Remember, Judah participated in that Baal worship that was brought by Omri and Ahab's house in the north. And you have followed their traditions. Therefore, I will give you over to ruin and your people to derision. You will bear the scorn of the nations. So there you've got God's judgment against Judah because of following the evil practices of Baal worship and turning to other gods instead of God. So the prophets spoke of blessings for the faithful. The prophets spoke judgment for evil. But the prophets also talked about God's graciousness, that God is a loving, gracious, and merciful God, and gave a promise of hope. What kind of hope? What kind of messages of hope? Amos chapter 9, verse 8, 14, and 15. Surely the eyes of the sovereign Lord are on the sinful kingdom. I will destroy it from the face of the earth, yet I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. I will bring back my exiled people Israel. They'll rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine, and they'll make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land that I've given them, says the Lord your God. So, even though God was pronouncing this judgment and would destroy these nations, he would save a remnant. He would have a remnant return. Israel would return, never again to be uprooted. And we'll talk more about that as we go on. All right, another message of hope, Micah 5. This should sound a little familiar to you, starting at verse 2. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel. Okay, and then this is Micah speaking late in the history of the southern nation, right? Whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Therefore, Israel will be abandoned. Okay, so he talks about the exile here and Israel's destruction. Until the time when she who is in labor gives birth and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of Yahweh, in the majesty of the name of Yahweh as God. And they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And he will be their peace. So, what kind of hope? Even though there's all this destruction coming, this judgment for our sins, God will bring back this remnant, we saw in Amos, and then in Micah, God will raise up a ruler. A great ruler, a ruler unlike any before, even like David, even better than David. Okay? So we have this promise that a remnant would return, that Israel, that Judah would be resurrected. Now that's unique. Okay, you look at other religions, you look at other peoples, other nations, and the prophets of those nations would foretell destruction, and that destruction would happen. But never have we seen prophets foretell resurrection. But now we have. These prophets here, God's prophets to God's people, foretold the resurrection of God's people. Okay? So now let's look at the picture today. And if you can look at your picture as we walk through, and we see a few elements here. The first thing we see is this figure in the center, down here, busy writing, okay? And that's the prophet, and he speaks to Israel. He spoke verbally and personally to Israel, but he also, we have a lot of letters that where we have their words written down. The withered tree and the barren earth, okay, the dismal-looking nature of things, reminds us that these prophets came and spoke during times of crisis. And we've already kind of talked about that. You know, look at the heavy hitters. Okay, Elijah came during the time of Ahab. And Elisha followed him up as Ahab's descendants continued to spread this Baalism. Isaiah came during the time that the northern nation was being destroyed. Jeremiah came during the time that the southern nation was being destroyed. So these prophets came during times of crisis. God sent because he especially wanted to call to his people. Now there's this young boy who's pointing to the green tree on the horizon. And this reminds us that besides recalling the destiny that we talked about a few weeks ago, the prophet came and spoke promises of hope. He gave hope for Israel's future. There's a green tree out there. There's life out there. We've got this dead earth picture here, but yet there's life in the future. Now, if you also look, there's these manuscripts. There's six of them. There's four of them rolled up, and then he's writing one, and the other guy's reading one. And this reminds us that of these messages of hope, there were six specific promises of hope that were given by the prophet. And these six promises we see at the top of page 3, and we have the coming of a Messiah out of David's seed. Okay, we've heard this before. This was promised to David. But yet now, during these prophets, they make it clear. And they state more about it. And they restate it over and over again. And Isaiah 11 is kind of a key chapter that where we see this. But we'll talk about all these. But in Isaiah 11, it talks about how a shoot would come from the stump of Jesse. And is referring to the Messiah. The second promise is the birth of a new era. Okay, Isaiah 32 talks to that. Then the restoration of paradise. Remember God's divine intentions. We see that in Isaiah 51. The exaltation of Mount Zion. Okay, we see that in Isaiah 2. We'll talk about that. The return of a remnant. We've already touched on that, but we'll talk more about it. But this is one of the key promises that and messages of hope that the prophet brought. And we see that in Isaiah 10, where a remnant shall return. And the suffering servant. Okay, we are now going through this study In fact, this study will be given, this lesson will be given on Palm Sunday and the Monday after for the Monday night class. So this is Holy Week, the time that we remember how this Messiah, how this servant of God truly suffered on our behalf. So a very timely message here in Isaiah 53. Tell you what, if you have not read Isaiah 53, and especially this week, as we're looking at the passion of Jesus, read Isaiah 53 and look at what the prophet had to say and how Jesus fulfilled it in his passion. The prophet here, Isaiah, spoke of things that didn't even exist. Crucifixion didn't exist back in Isaiah's time. Crucifixion existed only for a very short period in all of history, and it happened to be that short period in which Jesus was there, and only crucifixion could have fulfilled a lot of these prophecies that that the prophet spoke about the suffering servant. Okay, so let's talk about each one of these specific promises. Okay, the first one, which we'll probably spend more time on than any of the others, is the coming of a Messiah out of David's seed. When do we first learn that a Messiah will come from Judah? Okay, because he came from Judah, which is, you know, David's from Bethlehem, a town in Judah. When do we first learn about it? Genesis 49. And this is Jacob on his deathbed, and he called his sons and said, "Gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come." Okay, so he's telling all of his sons what will happen. And what does he say about Judah? Verse 10, he says, "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his." Okay? So Jacob included in his prophecy, or in his blessing for Judah, the prophecy of a Messiah that would come from Judah. Okay? And there's, we start seeing some glimpses of what this Messiahship would all be about. Now, God made a promise to David that included the promised Messiah. We see that in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 16. It says, God says, "Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." Okay? So God made a promise to David that his dynasty would last forever. And it has. And there's a descendant of David on the throne right now, and that is Jesus Christ. So, how did the prophet remind the Jews that David's kingdom would never end? Look at, let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 to 7. This will sound familiar. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there'll be no end. He'll reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of Yahweh Almighty will accomplish this." So here we see Isaiah saying, and other prophets as well, that a Messiah would come and reign forever on David's throne. And Jesus has done that. Now, when they talked about the Messiah, okay, Messiah is Hebrew for the anointed one. The Greek word that means the anointed one is Christ. So when we say Messiah or we say Christ, we're saying the same thing in two different languages. So when they talked about, when the Jews talked about the Messiah, what were they looking for? What kind of Messiah would they expect? Jeremiah 23, verses 5 to 6. "The days are coming, declares Yahweh, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. And this is the name by which he will be called, Yahweh our righteousness." So what kind of Messiah were they looking for? A king. A king like David. A king who would reign wisely. Who would do what is just and right. A king that was a man after God's heart. A king that would bring righteousness to the nation. That's what they were looking for. The prophecies, you know, the prophecies kind of pointed them to that, but we see that the kingdom's a little different than what they thought, right? Now, this Messiah would come and lead Israel back to her destiny, right? That's what this is all about. How would the Messiah do that? Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 4 and verse 10. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Yahweh. And he will delight in the fear of Yahweh. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness, he will judge the needy. With justice, he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the bread of his lips. He will slay the wicked. And in verse 10, in that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. So this Messiah would rule in righteousness. Okay, he would have the Spirit of God, the Spirit of understanding and wisdom and counsel and power and knowledge and the fear of Yahweh, and will delight in the fear of the Lord. And in verse 4, with righteousness he will judge. So he would rule in righteousness, and as a result, in verse 10, the nations will rally to him. What's all that about? Blessed to be a blessing. I will bless you so that you will be a blessing, and through you all peoples on earth will be blessed. And as the nations are attracted to God through these people, that's what they were called to do, is attract people to God through showing their relationship with him. And now this Messiah would make that happen. So this Messiah would come. They were looking for a king, and Jesus had disciples that figured out who he was. And what did he tell them? Look at Matthew 16, starting at verse 13. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Well, some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "Well, what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. You're the Messiah." "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah," Jesus replied, "for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven." In verse 20, then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. So after they realized that he was the Messiah, the Christ, he made sure they understood that. He then told them, don't tell anybody. Why not? Well, go back to the Jeremiah 23:5-6. What kind of king did they expect? What kind of Messiah did they expect? They expected a king. And when people realized that Jesus was the Messiah, they were going to look at him to be a king. In fact, after he fed the 5,000, what happened? The people tried to rally around him to make him king. And he had to go off and hide so that they wouldn't do that. So he told his disciples not to tell anyone. Now, then take a look, John 18, verse 36. What does Jesus tell Pilate? Okay, he says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." Well, if the Jews would hear that, they'd go, "Well, this guy obviously is not the Messiah, because the Messiah is going to come and restore Israel to greatness, restore the kingdom to Israel, get rid of these Romans," right? And Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom is of a different place." So they wouldn't understand. So that's why he didn't want that spread. But at least the disciples understood, right? Well, take a look at Acts 1, verse 6. This is right before Jesus ascends, after he's died and risen. And right before he ascends, he's already taught them everything. In verse 6, it says, "So that when they met together, they asked him, 'Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel?'" Look at how they still don't get it. The disciples, even after the 3 years of time they spent with him, after he's explained things, they're still thinking that Jesus is going to be an earthly king. They still don't get it. When do they finally get it? Well, Jesus says, You don't understand all these things now, but later you're going to understand when the Holy Spirit comes on you and explains all these things that I've been telling you. When the Holy Spirit came on them on the day of Pentecost, then they understood. They truly understood. And then spread the gospel and brought other people into faith, into saving faith in Jesus Christ. Okay, so the first message of hope, promise of hope that we hear from the prophets is the coming of a Messiah out of the lineage of David. All right, the next one we have is the birth of a new era. The birth of a new era. So what kind of new era? What does that mean? What kind of new era did the prophet promise? Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34. The time is coming, declares Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, even though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. So this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds, and I'll write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, "Know Yahweh," because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares Yahweh. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. This is quite a new era. It's a new covenant, this great covenant that was given on Mount Sinai, where God laid it out, what His expectations are, what His desire for a relationship is all about with us. He said, I'm going to have a new covenant. And this new covenant is going to involve writing my law on their hearts. They're going to know me. They won't have to look to Mount Sinai to know me. And I'm going to forgive their sins. That's how I'm going to restore the relationship that they've broken with me, with their sins. So, what kind of atmosphere would be characteristic of this new era? Isaiah 32, starting at verse 16. Justice will dwell in the desert, and righteousness live in the fertile field. The fruit of righteousness will be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and confidence forever. My people will live in peaceful dwelling places, in secure homes, in undisturbed places of rest. Though hail flattens the forest and the city is leveled completely, how blessed you will be, sowing your seed by every stream and letting your cattle and donkeys roam free. So peace and righteousness would prevail in this new era. Okay? So quite a message of hope, especially during all the time of warfare that these people saw, that resulted from their rejection of God, that was God's judgment on them. Okay, so the birth of a new era. The next one is that paradise would be restored. Okay, what does that mean? Well, remember when we talked about paradise? This was our very first picture, our very first lesson, other than our intro lesson. This was Genesis 1, God's divine intentions. That was paradise. So, how would paradise be restored? Let's look at some verses. Ezekiel 36, 25 to 28. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your impurities and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone, and I'll give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit in you, and I will move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. You will live in the land that I gave your forefathers. You will be my people, and I will be your God. What is this? This is talking about the relationship with God would be restored. Back to the way that God originally intended, with a perfect harmony with God. Okay? So paradise would be restored by having harmony with God. Micah chapter 4, verses 3 to 4. He will judge between many peoples and settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Every man will sit under his own vine tree and under his own fig tree. No one will make them afraid, for Yahweh Almighty has spoken. So what do we have here? They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Why would they do that? Because they don't need swords and spears anymore. Why not? Because there's peace. Because there's no longer war. Because there's no longer animosity between people. Because there's now harmony with others. Paradise would be restored, bringing harmony with others. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 6 to 9. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will feed them, or will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, and the young will lie down together. The lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all of my holy mountain. For the earth will be full of the knowledge of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. Harmony with nature, right? Look at this. You'll have these normal enemies, these natural enemies, will be harmonious together, okay? Will live together. And they will neither harm nor destroy, because the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord that brings this great harmony, God's divine intentions. All right, and then Isaiah 35, verse 10. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Their heads will be crowned with everlasting joy. They'll be overflowing with gladness and joy. There will not be any sorrow or sighing any longer. Harmony with self. Harmony with self. Let's look at one more verse, Isaiah 51, verse 3. Yahweh will surely comfort Zion and will look with compassion on all her ruins, and he will make her deserts like Eden, her wastelands like the garden of Yahweh. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the sound of singing. Now there's you a picture of Eden, of God's divine intentions. Okay, her deserts, the deserts of Judah, that nothing can live in, nothing can grow in, people can't live in, it will become like Eden under God's divine intentions. Paradise would be restored. Joy and gladness will be found in her. Paradise would be restored. Harmony with God, harmony with others, harmony with nature, and harmony with self. Restoring God's divine intentions. Okay, the next message, the next promise, the next message of hope is the exaltation of Mount Zion. Okay, what is that? Well, first, the question really is, what is Mount Zion? Okay, if it's going to be exalted, we better first figure out what it is. Psalm 2, verse 6. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. Okay, what is that? I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. What's this holy hill? God's holy hill is in Jerusalem. It's the hill upon which the temple was built. That hill in Jerusalem is called Zion. Okay? When we talk about Mount Zion, we're talking about that hill in Jerusalem where the temple was built. So, how would Zion be exalted? Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. In the last days, the mountain of Yahweh's temple will be established as chief among mountains. Okay, so in other words, this is Mount Zion, right? The mountain of Yahweh's temple. It will be raised above the hills and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. So it says that Mount Zion would be established as chief among all mountains. What's this talking about? Well, you know, remember we've seen how high places were used to worship various gods? Well, those all pale in comparison to God's hill. okay, to Mount Zion. And it would be raised up so much so that people from all over would want to come to Jerusalem, would want to come to Mount Zion, would want to come to God's holy hill to learn about him. And look, that's happening today, right? So why? Why would non-Jews want to learn about God and his ways? Because isn't Yahweh just the God of the Jews? Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6. He says, "It's too small of a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel that I've kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, so that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." Okay, the Messiah wasn't just going to come for the Jews. That's too small of a thing. That's making God smaller than he is. Instead, the Messiah was going to come to bring all people to God. "I will make you a light to the Gentiles to bring salvation to all people." That's why non-Jews would want to know, because of the salvation that's offered. God's plan of salvation was not just for the Jews. The Jews were the vehicle through whom God would bring his salvation. Okay? "Blessed to be a blessing. I will bless you so that you will be a blessing, and through you all people on earth will be blessed." So, this new kingdom of with Mount Zion here, how did Jesus clarify the nature of this new kingdom? Well, we've already looked at John 18:36, where he says, "My kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom's of another place." So he pointed out that this exaltation of Mount Zion, this kingdom, was not a political kingdom. Matthew chapter 12, verse 6, Jesus says, "I tell you that one greater than the temple is here." One greater than the temple is here. So the temple on Mount Zion does not hold God, because there's one even greater than the temple. God cannot be confined by the temple. In fact, when the temple was dedicated, when Solomon dedicated the temple first, he in his prayer said, "God, we know that you cannot be confined by anything built by human hands. But when people look to this temple, may they remember you and may you remember them." So the temple is not confining God. Jesus is greater than the temple. So Mount Zion's exalted through his ministry. And then Matthew 28, verse 19, "Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit." So the church must go out and bring God's message to the world. That's what exaltation of Mount Zion is all about, is to go and bring others to God's presence, into God's presence. Okay? The fifth message, the return of a remnant. We've touched on that before, but let's just read some verses here out of Isaiah chapter 10, verses 20 to 22. "In that day, the remnant of Israel, the survivors of the house of Jacob, will no longer rely on him who struck them down, but will truly rely on Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return. A remnant of Jacob will return to the mighty God. Though your people, O Israel, be like sand on the sea, only a remnant will return. Destruction has been decreed, overwhelming and righteous." So a remnant would return. A select remnant of the exiles would return. There would be some survivors. And they would no longer rely on him who struck them down. That is, the Babylonians, on Nebuchadnezzar. But instead, they would rely, they would depend on, they would put their trust in God. And God would take that select remnant and return them back to the land that he had prepared for them. Okay? All right, one more message, and that's this big message of the suffering servant. The suffering servant. And Isaiah really brings this out. And there's four servant songs in Isaiah that bring out the role of the Messiah as the suffering servant. Now, why? Well, what was God's original calling for the Jews to be? Isaiah 41, verses 8 to 9 says, "But you, O Israel, my servant, Okay, he called Israel to be a servant. Jacob, whom I've chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend. I took you from the ends of the earth, from its farthest corners, I called you. I said, you are my servant. I've chosen you and have not rejected you. So God called these people, the Jews, to be his servant. That's what the whole blessed to be a blessing is about. God didn't say, I'm calling you so that I will bless you. He says, I'm calling you and blessing you so that you will be my servant and be a blessing to others, and through you all people on earth will be blessed. So the Jews were called to be his servant. Okay? How well did they do? They didn't. Okay? They forgot that role. They forgot their purpose, their destiny. So God then would raise up a new servant. And how would God's new servant suffer for the sake of others? This is the Isaiah 53. We'll just read a few of the verses, but again, this speaks very heavily towards what happened to Jesus in his last days. Verse 4, surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us have turned to his own way, and Yahweh has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yet it was Yahweh's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer, as though Yahweh makes his life a guilt offering. He will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of Yahweh will prosper in his hands. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. So he'd rise from the dead, right? By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. So the Messiah would be like a guilt offering. He would carry our sins. He would justify many. That's why he suffered. He suffered by taking our sins upon himself and in doing so, removing those sins from us and allowing us to come back into a restored paradise relationship with God. Okay? Now, there are four servant songs in Isaiah that talk about this role of the suffering servant. And so let's look at some of those. Isaiah 42 is one of them. Well, let's read verses 1 through 7. Here's my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he'll bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he won't even break, and a smoldering wick he won't snuff out. In faithfulness he'll bring forth justice. He won't falter or be discouraged till he establishes justice on earth. In his law the islands will put their hope. This is what God, Yahweh, says. He who stretched the heavens, created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to its people and life to those who walk on it. He says, I, Yahweh, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles, to open eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. So, you see the role of the servant that Jesus had. Here's my servant, my chosen one, in whom I delight. He will establish justice on earth. Okay. So, there we have the definition of the servant of the Lord. The Messiah would be the servant that Israel never was. Isaiah chapter 49, read verses 1 through 6. And there's more verses to these, but we're just going to read some key points. Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant nations. Before I was born, Yahweh called me. From my birth, he has made mention of my name. He made my mouth like a sharpened sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me into a polished arrow and concealed me in his quiver. He said to me, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will display my splendor. But I said, I've labored to no purpose. I've spent my strength in vain for nothing. Yet what's due me is in the Lord's hand, and my reward is with my God. And now Yahweh says, He who formed me in the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back to himself and gather Israel to himself, for I am honored in the eyes of Yahweh and of my God, and my God has been my strength. He says, it's too small of a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. This servant would come and bring salvation to the ends of the earth. Okay, not just, it wasn't enough to restore Israel, but also to save the whole world. Then the next chapter, we see another aspect of this servant, verses 4 to 9. The sovereign Yahweh has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. The sovereign Yahweh has opened my ears, and I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting, because the sovereign Yahweh helps me. I will not be disgraced. Therefore, I've set my face like flint, and I know I will not be put to shame. He who vindicates me is near. Who then will bring charges against me? Let's face each other. Who's my accuser? Let him confront me. It is the sovereign Yahweh who helps me. Who is he that will condemn me? They'll all wear out like a garment. The moss will eat them up. Does this sound familiar? I will offer my back to be beaten, my cheeks to pull out my beard. That's what they did to Jesus. And he did not fight back, just as he says here. Okay, I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back, he said. So Jesus was this Messiah. And then we have chapter 53, but it actually kind of starts in chapter 52. We'll read verses 12 through, or 13 through 12. Well, all of chapter 53. Let's go ahead and read it all. But we'll start in chapter 12, verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely. He'll be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. Okay, this talks about how Jesus was beaten. So will he sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. Okay? Look at it. We're thousands of years later, and people are still talking about Jesus, and people shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. For who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of Yahweh been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, and yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The judgment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each one of us has turned to his own way, and Yahweh has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, and yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he'd done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. And yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though Yahweh makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his day, and the will of Yahweh will prosper in his hands. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life, and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Now you tell me how you can read this and not, and understand anything about what it's being said, except in the 2020 hindsight of seeing what Jesus did. This tells exactly what happened with Jesus. Psalm 22 tells exactly what happened during his crucifixion. And these were hundreds of years before Jesus did this. Okay? So look at this message of hope. Isaiah is talking about this servant that would come, this Messiah that would come. Did Isaiah understand this? Did the other prophets that talked about these promises of hope understand what they were saying? Turn to 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 to 12. Peter says, concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was come to you, they searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and the circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, when they spoke of the things that had now been told you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Even angels long to look into these things. So Peter points out that these prophets, they did not understand what they were saying. So people, when they were trying to understand, prophet, what are you saying? He goes, I don't know. I'm just saying what God's telling me to say. The prophet didn't understand. They searched intently and anxiously, wanting to know what God meant by what he was telling them to say. But faithfully, they delivered God's message. It wasn't their calling to understand, but rather their calling to be the messenger, to deliver the message. And now we get to, after seeing what God did through his son, Jesus Christ, we get to look back and see how God's plan was fulfilled. How those promises of hope that the prophets gave were completely fulfilled through Jesus Christ, God's son. So we then look at this other role of the prophet. If we look back at our picture, this figure in the center is the prophet who speaks to Israel, but also to all people, to all of God's people. The withered tree and the barren earth reminds us that the prophets came during crisis times in Israel. But the young boy who points to the green tree on the horizon, all is not dead. The prophet gave hopes for Israel's future. And there were six manuscripts reminding us that there are six specific promises of hope that were given by the prophet. The coming of a Messiah out of David's seed. The birth of a new era. The restoration of paradise. The exaltation of Mount Zion, the return of a remnant, and a suffering servant. And you can look at a little bit more about those and get some of the details of some of these prophecies and promises in on pages 5 and 6. And I'll just let you take a look at those on your own. Let's close with prayer. God our Father, what a great and loving God you are, that you care so much for us, that, well, as we've looked at the stories of the kings, that you were extremely patient with them, continuing to send your prophets, prophets that those people rejected, but yet you still sent them because you love these people, you love us, and you wanted them to come back to you, just as you want us to stay with you and come to you. We thank you for the work of the prophets. It was not a job that anyone really wanted because people didn't like the prophets because of the message that they brought, but it was your message. And it was a message that maybe wasn't always understood, but it's a message that you continue to reveal and explain to us through your Spirit. And as we look back at what you did through your Son, Jesus Christ, we see how you have conquered all the power of Satan that has destroyed the paradise that you intended for this creation and the relationship that you intended us to have with you. We thank and praise you in the name of him who took our infirmities on himself and suffered on our behalf and brought us your salvation. In Christ's name, amen.